Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, joining us now is a man who's got a massive brain.
Mike Florio.
He used to be a lawyer, then he decided to take his talents to the internet.
NBC Sports.
I'm sorry I'm late. I was talking to Robert Kraft.
Pro Football Talk.
I wouldn't listen to some of those people out there, especially guys like Mike Florio.
Mike Florio with Dan Bernstein on The Score.
Talk some football with Mike Florio. He is at Pro Football Talk. Pro Football Talk, NBC Sports, and joining us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing great. I like very much that this hour is sponsored by Phoenix Industrial Cleaning because the name reminds me of Kruger Industrial Smoothing from Seinfeld.
Well, Seinfeld has been, we've talked a lot about it with the death of Jerry Stiller. I know the show meant more to some than others, but obviously that's it's been, you know, memorable, remembering that characterization.
Jerry Stiller was awesome. And for me, I grew up in the 70s, and I remember seeing Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira on the Carol Burnett Show, and they were a great comedy team, husband and wife, the parents of Ben Stiller. And when he emerged on Seinfeld as George Costanza's father, Frank, I was stunned because there had already been a Frank Costanza who looked a lot like Carl Reiner, not like Jerry Stiller at all. And then all of a sudden, his dad is Jerry Stiller. And I thought, this is great. I love Jerry Stiller. And he was so good in that role. He stole every scene he was in. The outtakes that are floating around out there are fabulous. The incident where he cannot get out Del Boca Vista, no matter how hard he tries. It just, you know, celebrities age and pass all the time, and you can't get affected by every single one of them. Otherwise, you're going to be depressed all the time. But Jerry Stiller's passing really hit me on Monday. And he just was so good, so skilled. And I've been watching a lot of Seinfeld this week in his honor.
Now, Estelle Harris, who played George's mother, is my mother-in-law's cousin.
Wow.
And the accent, like, they sound so identical that it's frightening. And I hear it. Like, I hear that same exact New York accent and some of the ways, some of the speech pattern and everything. It's really eerie. Sometimes when I would watch that and hear it, because, and now with the hindsight, that it's, she sounds exactly like my mother-in-law.
The episode where Susan Ross, George's fiance, has the doll that looks just like Estelle and is constantly nagging George, and then Frank shows up and it starts nagging Frank, and Frank removes the head of the doll violently. there are so many great Frank Costanza moments. It's really every episode that he was in produced some memorable line or some memorable visual gag that he was involved in. Just incredible. I need to just watch the Frank Costanza episodes on a continuous loop.
So as we're watching basketball and baseball start to enter the meat of some of these reopening negotiations and trying to actually figure out how to do this, what is football learning, and what should football be looking for and making note of?
Well, I tell you what, Dan, one thing football should be looking for and making note of is the push and pull with the Players Association, because unlike the NBA collective bargaining agreement, which contains a force majeure clause that allows the NBA to say to the players, if there ain't no games, you don't get paid. And unlike the standard baseball player contract, which basically says if there aren't games due to a national emergency, these contracts are suspended, the NFL has no such protection, which gives the NFL Players Association a ton of leverage, because whatever suggestions the NFL may have to make to the players by way of a proposed adjustment to the working conditions. For example, we'd like to send the Rams to Las Vegas for the full season, and all the players are going to have to live in Las Vegas instead of at home in LA with their families. That's going to be something that will be negotiated between the union and the league. The ultimate leverage for the players is just to sit back and fold their arms and say, nope, 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 because they know that if all falls apart and there's no season, they all get paid. That is a powerful tool to have in your corner when it's time to figure out whatever plan B, C, D, E, all the way to F, Z, J, wherever is going to be as an alternative to playing 256 games. And frankly, I think that's one of the reasons why they're bound and determined to play 256 games, because they know they have to pay the players one way or the other. But at some point, to get back to your question and to finally answer it, watching what happens with the unions for the MLB and the NBA, watching how those fights play out from a PR standpoint, it's going to be very instructive on what the NFL can do, because even if the CBA doesn't back up the NFL's position, getting the fans on the owner's side could be a powerful tool to getting the NFLPA to cry uncle.
Well, that's obviously what baseball was trying to do by saying that they had given the players all these proposals when they hadn't. They said, oh, we've got an 80-page proposal for safety, but we're going to share this in the coming days. And meanwhile, already people have said, oh, these players are holding out. And J.B. Pritzker here, the governor of Illinois, was just saying that these players shouldn't be holding out for more money. It's really, it's amazing how easy it is. If you want to demonize players for being greedy, selfish, intransigent, all you've got to do is flip a switch. I mean, those are some of the easiest buttons to push in sports.
And why is that, Dan? Why do we do that? Why do fans align with the billionaire owners and not the millionaire? And in football, plenty of players aren't millionaires and never will be millionaires. But why do we align with the owners instead of the players, when the players are the ones we are watching? The players are the ones who are taking the risks, the physical risks. They're making the sacrifices. Whatever alternative plans will be proposed to any professional athlete, it's going to potentially impact their lives. Oh, and by the way, it puts them at risk of contracting the coronavirus and getting sick and possibly dying. And yet still, I think it just comes down to, it's easier to bully the players than it is to bully the owners, because the owners don't care. They're still rich. It's like the path of least resistance is the players. Let's make them feel bad. Let's jump on them. Let's yell at them, because it's going to be easier to get them to crack than it is to get the owners to crack. I really do think at some level that's what fans and media think, and that's why the players are the ones who get demonized, because we know it's easier to get them to say, okay, we'll take the deal and we'll go play.
I think it's that's true, and it's also considerably more complicated than that, because especially in football, I think with the fungibility of players, the next man up idea, the idea of, you know, one guy goes down and there's another guy whose face you can't see concealed behind a helmet, and it's just meat out there. You also have the what fantasy sports has done to commodify players, where fans are they default to this idea of them as interchangeable parts. They have felt like owners before, and that's their gambling life, is they can draft and trade, and they just see them that way, where the owners are not. No, there's no fantasy owning, where you're buying owners and moving owners around. I think some of it is a perverse psychological syndrome at this point.
I agree with you, and I think also we're more likely to resent the players as fans than the owners, because You know, look, it's one thing to resent people who have money. There's plenty of people in any given community who have money. And also, most of these folks are older, too. It's like, I really wouldn't trade places with somebody who's 87 years old and has $1 billion. I'd rather be younger. But when you see the young, strong, strapping man who's getting the glory and the fame and the everything that goes along with it, right, it's easier to resent and be jealous of those portions of the business than the guys who are sitting up in the shadows, counting their money and smoking their cigars.
And not to mention the obvious elephant in the room, that we tend to sympathize or empathize more easily with people who look like us and sound like us. And if you look at the way sports break down and the percentage of the population, there are more owners that look like the larger group of us than there are players. And I think that there's just an obvious connection there that can't be ignored.
Well, their houses sure don't look like ours. None of their houses.
Yeah, there's
none of their 20 houses spread throughout the globe look like any of our houses.
Yeah, no doubt. I wanted to bring up to you something that I was just discussing a couple of minutes ago, and I know you're getting a lot of this, and this was brought up by our afternoon host, Danny Parkins. We had a really good point about this yesterday, about the current tribalism, this current atmosphere where the reasonable observer is talking now about, as sports come back and as we try to throw all these switches back on, about the headwinds and about the dangers and about the risks and about the improbabilities based on medicine and science. And yet what you get out there is some of this, you hate sports, you don't like football, you don't want sports to come back, when it absolutely isn't. It's the furthest thing from the case for those of us whose livelihoods are intertwined with these sports coming back, that simultaneously one can love a sport, one can want desperately for it to come back, and can also speak reasonably and intelligently and objectively about what the headwinds are. And it makes me crazy that somehow that's conflated as not liking the sport or not wanting it to return.
We have become a society of Veruca Salts, at least that portion of the society, that not only wants what it wants, it doesn't want to hear anything that would in any way contradict the mere possibility of getting what you want. And that's what's crazy to me. If I say, well, these are things the NFL needs to be worried about, and these are things the NFL needs to take care of in order to have a season, there will be a segment of the population that says you're rooting for there to be no season. No, I'm not. If I was rooting for there to be no season, I'd keep my mouth shut. I'd sit back and let them drive the thing off a cliff and say, I told you so after. Or no, I wouldn't say I told you so. I didn't tell you anything because I was rooting for no football. Those of us who are spotting the issues, spotting the potential hurdles, like the inevitable showdown with the NFL Players Association, we're trying to get the fans, the media, and ultimately anyone from the NFL who's paying attention to all of the issues to be aware of the challenges to putting the product on the field. We want the product to be on the field. But it is amazing to me that grown men and women will plug their ears and say, la, 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 I'm not listening. Or even worse, shout you down. I was trying to think of a good example earlier today. Let me try this one out. I haven't articulated this yet. But it's kind of like if you are visiting with your doctor and you had some serious illness and your doctor says, you know what, you're getting better, but you need to keep taking your medicine. You need to continue this path. I know the medicine doesn't taste good. I know you don't like the side effects, but you need to keep doing it. And the patient says, why? And the doctor says, well, because if not, you'll get a lot sicker sooner rather than later. And then the patient responds by yelling at the doctor and saying, you're full of crap, and storming out of the room. I mean, would we act that way if that was how we were dealing with our own individual health? No. Why do we act that way when it deals with a broader issue, a societal health issue that could derail the football season if we don't take the medicine that needs to be taken, if we don't worry about the various signs and symptoms that may be out there that could require some sort of action? It really is astounding to me that there is that least common denominator of society that will take efforts to be careful and prudent and smart and say, you hate football.
The answer to that analogy is doctors talk all the time about the frustrations they have getting through to individual patients that they need to continue to take their medicine even after they start to feel better. believe me, there's been situations in my own family where someone says, well, you know, what happens? Like, oh, that medication, I didn't like the way that made me feel, so I stopped taking it. Like, what? Wait, what? No, you have to feel that way because your actual health was more important. It happens all the time. A course of antibiotics, even, where they say, even when you feel better, you've got to finish the course of antibiotics. Or people, this happens all the time with drugs that take time to work in arrears, SSRIs and other drugs. Doctors all the time. That's how dumb even individual people are. So it is incredibly frustrating, but I'm really not surprised at our overall level of selfishness and impatience in what's going on.
What takes this a step farther is when you choose not to take medication that has been prescribed for you, you only affect yourself. This issue entails potentially affecting others, and it's such a simple concept. Like, I really do feel like I'm trapped in a bad episode of the Twilight Zone from time to time, where there are so many people who are programmed to believe that we can do whatever we want, and if we want to accept the risk, that's perfectly fine. It's like, don't you understand that if you go out and live the life you want to live, there's a chance that you're going to get Meemaw or Papaw killed? How hard is it to understand that unless you have a firewall in your own personal life and you never see your grandparents or you never interact with anyone in your family who has diabetes or any other health condition, and I worry about the people out there who don't know they have the health condition and they're going to find out the hard way when COVID-19 kills them, there's just this conscious blind spot where it doesn't take a lot of brain power to understand how it works. People just choose to ignore it. Like, we just ignore it because we don't want to think about things that make us uncomfortable. We just get to the point where we've had enough. You know, we've had enough of worrying about this. Let's get back to normal life. Like, you can just flip a switch and it's going to get people killed. Anyway, I'm sure there's a segment of the audience that is pissed off at us for saying these things that are basic fundamental truths about which no one should disagree.
That's okay. I mean, it's funny you bring that up because I have a friend who just lost his mother to COVID, and it's exactly what happened, where she did not know she had an underlying pulmonary condition and didn't know how badly the type 2 diabetes had ravaged her immune system and her response system. And it wasn't until this happened and didn't know, really had no idea. So it's absolutely true, and that hits relatively close to home. So before we let you go, Mike, when we start looking at the calendar, what days are coming that are going to test the resolve of the NFL, test this stance of the NFL, of this powering through everything and of guaranteeing normalcy? Is it going to be the reopening of facilities? Is it going to be the reconvening of teams? Before we get to the idea of games, what are the rubber meets the road moments that are going to actually say whether or not they're serious about doing this?
Well, this Friday is the deadline for teams to have their basic plans for a phase one reopening of facilities, which does not yet factor players into it. It's just kind of like starting the engine up again so the facilities are ready when it's time to go to training camp, if and when they can go to training camp. May 19, next Tuesday, that is a virtual ownership meeting, at which time I think they'll make some decisions about things to come. But, you know, in a normal year, here's what happens, Dan. Memorial Day weekend to 4th of July, that is our kind of summer. Everyone sort of checks out a little bit. The world slows down a little bit. It's after the 4th of July that we start thinking, oh boy, summer is going to end and reality is going to return. And you start counting the days until Labor Day weekend. And if you're a football fan, that's good because you start making the final countdown to the return of football. I think after July 4, once the dust settles on the holiday, that's when we better start hearing some specific things about what the NFL plans to do by way of training camp. Because whenever it's very easy, whenever you can get the players in camp, you start counting forward however many weeks it's going to take to get them ready. Pete Carroll, the Seahawks coach, has said they're going to need 6 weeks to get guys ready. I'd be shocked if there's a preseason. I assume the preseason games will be replaced with scrimmages because it's not like fans are going to be there anyway. But if they intend to get this started September 10, Thursday night, Texans Chiefs on NBC, you got to work backward from there. And then you work a little bit backward from late July and figure out when we need to know what specifically is going to happen. And I really do think we'll kind of float through late May into early July, and they won't tell us anything, but they better start telling us things after 4th of July, or who knows what's going to happen when football season rolls around.
Mike, great stuff. Continued good health to you. Look forward to talking next week.
Thanks, Dan. See you.
That is Mike Florio of Pro Football Talk. And recently, as we talk about football and what football has to do to come back, Dr. Anthony Fauci spoke with Peter King a couple of days ago about the nature of the sport itself and what he thinks is possible or probable about the steps that need to be taken for it to return. Because football seems very certain of itself that this is going to happen. So I want to hear what Dr. Anthony Fauci said in regard to his expectations or his concerns for that. So we'll give that a listen. I'm Dan Bernstein. That's coming up next on The Score.
Former 90s Chicago Bulls Scott Burrell talked Last Dance with Mully and Haw.
You think that there will be some people that this turns off to Michael Jordan and those tactics?
That's another great question. You guys are good today. You guys are really, really good today. I do think it turns off some people. He had to be that way because he knew he was the best. They weren't coming to beat the Bulls. They were coming to beat Jordan.
Hear the entire Scott Burrell interview with Mully and Haw at 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
All our work is to continue to plan for the season and be ready for the season. The draft is a great example of that. We're moving forward to do that. We've modified our offseason to allow virtual workouts and offseason training. So all of that is going to try to make us ready for the season. One thing I've learned about what we're going through as a country is you can't tell a week from now, as much less 3 months from now. Mm-hmm. So our job is to be ready. We obviously will be ready to make alternatives. We're going to put public safety number one, as we always do, and make sure that our fans, our players, all the participants, coaches, everyone are able to be in a safe environment and make sure that we do it in a way that all of us will be proud of.
That's NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell with Robin Roberts. That was on Good Morning America on April 23rd. This segment is brought to you by DuckDuckGo Privacy. Want the same internet but more privacy? DuckDuckGo's got you covered. They help millions of people like you get privacy online without any trade-offs. With one download, you can search and browse privately, avoiding trackers, all for free. DuckDuckGo Privacy Simplified. So Roger Goodell wants to get football back. We all want football back, but they have to do it in a way that doesn't endanger the health of all the people involved and others connected to the people involved. National Institutes for Health Director Dr. Anthony Fauci was on Peter King's Football in America podcast, and he talked about how a potential spike in COVID-19 cases in the fall could affect fall and winter sports.
When I said there's no doubt the virus is going to return, that is in response to some who have said, oh, it's just going to disappear. So unlike the virus SARS back in 2002, when we had an outbreak of about 8,000 people and about close to 800 deaths, and then the virus essentially just petered out by good public health measures for the simple reason that it wasn't efficiently or effectively transmitted from one person to another. In other words, it was not an efficient spreader, so that when you damp down on it with public health measures, it actually got to the point where it disappeared. That's not the case with this novel coronavirus. It is so transmissible and it is so widespread throughout the world that even if our infections get well controlled and go down dramatically during the summer, there is virtually no chance it will be eradicated, which means there will be infections in the southern hemisphere, in South Africa, in Argentina, places like that. And with the travel, the global travel every single day of literally hundreds of thousands of people coming into the United States every day from all over, there's no chance we're going to be virus free. Now, the football season and what the fall is going to mean. It will be entirely dependent on the effectiveness with which we as a society respond to the inevitable outbreak that will occur. So what are the options? If we let it just go and we don't have a good response, you could have an outbreak somewhat similar, probably not as bad, because we got hit really with a 1-2 punch, particularly New York City and New Orleans and Chicago. But we can expect an outbreak that would be serious. That's if we do nothing. So it's inconceivable that we would do nothing. So what we're saying is, what is going to be the effectiveness of our response? Right now in the winter, as you can see, we did not exactly have an overwhelmingly successful response. There was a misstep with testing in the beginning. There wasn't enough tests. Now that we're starting to get enough tests, there wasn't enough personal protective equipment that we could give to the healthcare workers. There wasn't enough personal protective equipment to do contact tracing. That was January, nothing was here, but February, March, and April. Right. So now we're in May. Now, even if the virus goes down dramatically in June and July and August, as the virus starts returning in the fall, it would be, in my mind, shame on us if we don't have in place all of the mechanisms to prevent it from blowing up again. In other words, enough testing to test everybody that needs to be tested, enough testing so that when someone gets infected, you can immediately do contact tracing and isolation to prevent the infection from going to a couple of infections to hundreds of infections. That's how you control an outbreak. So practically speaking, the success or failure, the ability or not to actually have a football season is going to depend just on what I said. Because if we're ineffective and we get in other words, if things are the way they are now, I'm speaking to you from Washington, D.C. We're still having an outbreak in Washington, D.C. It is not yet adequately controlled. Hopefully in the next couple of weeks, it will be. So if that's even close to the case, I don't see fans in the football field. I could see a hybrid of it, which has been suggested for the baseball season, where you test all the players and essentially keep them segregated for a period of time, get them to play and watch just on television. The difference between baseball and football is one is so much more of a contact sport. But if all of the players are tested and all of the players are negative and those who are positive, you know, are taken out of commission for 14 days until they become negative, then that's a possibility. I mean, I'm giving you a wide range of things, but what I'm really saying, it's unpredictable depending upon how we respond in the fall.
I know how dangerous hypotheticals are, but suppose you test a team of 53 players on a Saturday night and four of them test positive. Is there a level at which...
Yeah, you got a problem there. You know why?
Yeah.
Because it is likely that if four of them are positive and they've been hanging around together, that the other ones negative are really positive. So, I mean, if you have one outlier, I think you might get away. But once you wind up having a situation where it looks like it's spread within a team, you got a real problem.
Yeah.
You got to shut it down.
And also, I take it that teams have to be willing to say, if Patrick Mahomes tests positive on Saturday night, he's got to disappear for 2 weeks.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It would be malpractice in medicine to put him on the field. Absolutely.
Is there anything else you want to say that you feel I should know?
No, I think we covered it pretty well.
Yeah.
You get the feeling, I mean, the point I'm making, it is uncertain, and you have to play it by ear according to the level of infection in the community. That's going to determine, you know, I've often said it, I've been quoted in the papers many times, the virus decides many times what the decision must be, not us. You know, we ultimately make the decision, but the virus makes the decision for us.
What don't you get? Like, that's so straightforward. There's no jargon. There's nothing confusing. And that's the guy who our government is relying on to help inform some of these decisions. And too few people are listening to Dr. Anthony Fauci and what he's saying we need. And to his point, he brings up Patrick Mahomes. But we're thinking about this. Whatever the NBA is trying to do, and if they have some sort of bubble league in Las Vegas or in Disney World, and say they jump to the playoffs and you're doing whatever it may be, whether it's three-game series or some sort of tournament, you have to be ready. If you're the Lakers and LeBron James test positive, and LeBron James was in a room with Anthony Davis for 2 hours or whatever it may be, those guys are both out for 2 weeks. No ifs, ands, or buts. So when they talk about how, yeah, we're going to deal with how what we do when someone inevitably tests positive, that person has to be removed, and then you contact trace, and you have to figure out who was where with them. There's been some really good stuff published lately, and I've been trying my best to follow some of the smartest people involved. And there was a recent study that's been done, and now some of the science is coming in about what we knew, what was going on in January and February and March before this got crazy, how some of this was being spread. And it isn't just someone sneezing on you. It's a matter, as they understand it now, of total viral load. Of it, it's not just necessarily an amount of it that is introduced at one point. It could be more time spent indoors with someone getting multiple exposures of smaller amounts of the virus that build to the larger level. And if you're at a three-hour dinner and you're sitting downwind in an air current. They did this. They traced this to people sitting in a restaurant where one person who was asymptomatic and positive was still shedding virus and was responsible for getting 10 people sick. The people that were sitting upwind of this person's table in the restaurant were fine. And when I say wind, I mean literally the internal currents of the HVAC. That the downwind people at the tables that were down from the current did get sick. I mean, little things like that, and it's over the course of time. Had it been a 10-minute exposure, that's different from a 2 to 3 hour exposure. It's why people are getting it at home. It's why inside is much more of a concern than outside. That's a huge advantage that baseball has right now, and that football will have regardless. But it is terrifying and fascinating what they're learning. Like I mentioned before, the exposures, if you get the chance, there is a study that was done about the dangers of buffets and food sharing and how at a wedding or at some sort of party, some communal event, they did an invisible dye. It could only be detected via a black light of some kind. And they put it in the mashed potatoes or whatever it was. There's different versions of this. And they just showed how quickly one person, when they put this invisible dye on their hands, how one person can spread this. Then they tested everybody, and it was shared with the entire room by the end of an hour of people making contact with each other and touching things and sharing things. And it really shows how starkly some of this stuff can occur, some of the illustrations of it. And I mentioned before the choir event where they realized after the fact that a room full of people singing was an unfortunately incredibly effective way to aerosolize this particular virus. And the more, with every day that goes by and the forensic science that's being done, they're learning more and more and more about it. It's going to inform some kind of response. We have the Midday Midway coming up next. I have a really strange discovery in England that we need to get to. And I also, we've got an item, a famous musical item that is going up for auction. And I wanted to see what you think somebody would pay for it. And I'll ask right now, what do you think they expect to get for Kurt Cobain's acoustic guitar that he used on MTV Unplugged? That is going to go up for auction, and I've got the estimates for what they think that's going to fetch. I also want to give an example. I want to compliment an area business for how they're going about their business. I had necessitated a unexpected trip to a store just because of a necessity. And again, not an endorsement, not a plug, not a commercial of any kind. It's just an example of a business going out of their way to try to do something correctly that probably could be emulated. I'm Dan Bernstein. Midday Midway coming up on The Score.
NFL football fans, let The Score hook you up while you're keeping safe at home as we air NFL Classics featuring some of the biggest games in NFL history starting tomorrow night at 7.
Join us for the NFC Championship game from January 18th, 2015. The Packers versus the Seahawks.
Here's Lynch. Lynch.
starting tomorrow night at 7 on Sports Radio 670 The Score, Chicago Sports Station, a production of Westwood One Sports. This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
The first half or the second half, you know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel
the Midday Midway with Dan Bernstein on The Score.
We have been busy so far leading up to the Midday Midway. We talked about the unfortunate comments that Governor Pritzker made at his press conference yesterday, calling out baseball players for something they frankly haven't done. And also the way the question led him into the answer. He might have been best served demurring and just saying, I did something I don't want to comment on until I know more about it, because he pushed some buttons at a time where it's exactly what Rob Manfred and MLB probably wanted. And it's so easy to do, to make the players look greedy when all they're doing is looking out for not just their financial best interest, but for their health and for the health of their families. We replayed some of what Casey Johnson said about the differences between the trust that basketball players have in their commissioner and the trust baseball players have in theirs, and also what is actually going on in the NBA on their board of governors call and what they're trying to do. Mike Florio had some impassioned stuff regarding the NFL. We replayed some of the comments from Dr. Anthony Fauci. He talked about what football would need to return and what we're looking at with the likelihood of a resurgence in the fall, near certainty of a resurgence in the fall. And all of that has informed today's talk. So I asked you what you thought Kurt Cobain's guitar from the 1993 MTV Unplugged performance would be expected to garner at auction next month. Now, I didn't know. It's a rare guitar. It's a D18E. And it is made, it's by the Martin Guitar Company. It is one of only 302 D18Es made by the Martin Guitar Company that's making instruments since 1833. It's also customized. The Cobain added a Bartolini pickup to the sound hole, decorated the hard shell case that's included in the lot. And that is, there's a flyer from Poison Idea's 1990 album Feel the Darkness as part of it. There are three baggage claim stubs that are still stuck to the handle. The case includes half a pack of Martin guitar strings, three guitar picks, and a suede stash bag decorated with a miniature silver spoon, fork, and knife. So this is full deluxe in the packaging, and it's an electric acoustic. So not only is there a pickup on there, but there are actually, there's a volume switch, and probably the other one's a gain switch, I would imagine. And it's Hendrix. He's playing it upside down, and you can tell because the pick guard is on top of the sound hole instead of below it. So it really is unique. Any guesses as to how much money they think this is going to raise at auction?
All right, I'm going to take a guess, and I don't even know if the hardware and the model matters as much as how iconic that guitar is and how iconic that performance was. I think it starts at like $2 million. I think that could be one of the most valuable items in rock and roll history, especially considering all the details you laid out about the half-used bag of strings and the stash bag and all the cool things that make it so personal. I think that could be one of the most expensive rock and roll items ever auctioned.
Now, I'm not ruling that out, but they're saying their expectation is it will sell for at least $1 million. And sometimes these things go crazy. All it takes is two. And that's the thing about an auction, that it depends on the collector. It depends on how motivated somebody is. It could be a museum. It could be a private business. It could just be a really wealthy individual or another musician. Who knows? But they're saying minimum of $1 million.
Well, let me say this.
If
this was at the Country Music Hall of, or I'm sorry, that's just force of habit. If this was at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I would seek it out. It would be one of the first things I circled on my trip to go see. That concert on MTV was so memorable. And I'm trying to remember if it aired for the first time right after he died. So it was almost like watching Awake on TV. I don't remember the timing of it, but it was either right before or right after he passed, and the album came out, and it's just something that to me is one of those moments in rock and roll history that's frozen in time, and to have that iconic of an item to me would be, it's almost, you can't even put a value on it. If the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame should do everything they can to get it.
We hear those songs played. WXRT revisits that concert, plays those songs a lot. Which song was most memorable to you?
The Man Who Sold the World, which obviously is a Bowie song. But
yes,
that's the one
me
that,
too.
He made it so Cobain and made it so Nirvana. And I don't know why that's the one that sticks out to me, but I think it just captures the essence of that performance so well. That to me is, as soon as you asked me that question, I immediately knew the answer.
That was to me, it's also the actual guitar notes that he plays and how he plays them. At the end of each line, there's sort of that walking series of notes. Mm-hmm. And to have an acoustic bass playing along with that, and it's just you because you're hearing it and you're actually seeing the fingering and seeing how he's doing it live like that. I remember watching that first run when they first aired and just sitting just gobsmacked by it. It was you're right, it was something really heavy about it.
You're right, and you could hear all the instrument, like you said, with the bass. You could also hear Dave Grohl's drum brushes on the song. Like, you hear every part of that performance in that particular song. I think that just summarizes the whole thing very well.
Well, I say you bid on it then. Get some backers, okay. Go in there and find your $2 million.
Great. I got $36 in my wallet. How's that? It's a start.
A theme of the Midday Midway has been something that's apparently really popular in Europe. I don't know how popular it is here. Magnet fishing. And as you know, when I do these stories, you're thinking, oh, God, another unexploded bomb, another grenade, because that always seems to be what it is some English magnet fisherman finds an unexploded World War II bit of ordnance. But that's not the case here. People are out magnet fishing, and a magnet fisherman out with his two sons at a river in Coventry reeled in almost 60 mysterious cubes thought to show a sacred numerical inscription. Will Reed found the hall of engraved lead squares believed to be connected to a mystical Hindu prayer ritual while sifting through shallow water. The facets of the objects, which are small enough to hold between finger and thumb, they look like they're the size of dice, they're set into grids with inscriptions thought to be in Sanskrit. At first, he thought the cubes were random pieces of debris littering the bottom of the River So in South Coventry. But his sons took a closer look, and they noticed detailed inscriptions set into the faces of the squares. He said, this is our daily activity in lockdown. We were at a relatively isolated spot. We found keys, we found pennies, and other bits, and we looked down and saw what we thought were tiles. He said, I was live streaming to friends on Facebook. I bent down and started picking them up. I thought they might be rocks. I showed them to the camera, and then more and more and more kept appearing. So he posted the images on Facebook, and then on Reddit. And based on the responses, he's learning the objects are connected to a Hindu prayer ritual. They're Indian in origin. They show incantations for prayers, which take effect when they are thrown in running water. Other than a different face on one side, all of the cubes are identical, possibly because they contain a numerical formula to summon the protection of Rahu, described by the Shrivanaya astrology website as a planet with godlike powers. How cool is this? Rahu's sphere of control includes thieves, magicians, snakes, poison, jails, and isolated places. Responses to the pictures on social media suggest the characters are in Sanskrit, the liturgical language of Hinduism, and show yantra, which are mystical diagrams that are used for worship. There is a numerical formula that relates to Rahu, and worshippers who place the magic square in running water receive protection of Rahu from hidden enemies, wrong diagnosis of illness, and deceit. So now we got to make sure that we got this all right. Maybe this is the cure to the global pandemic if we can absolutely find the protection of Rahu. So my laptop crapped out and died completely. Absolutely
just finally, it's 10 years old, which is old in dog years for a laptop, and it just finally wheezed its last breath, and I was getting all sorts of, you know, those really weird messages and the weird beeping noises, and you know, it says like beginning disk repair file 1 of 729,646, and then it's creeping along like 1, 2, 3, 4, and I'm thinking, uh-oh. So my history with computers is, if something's 10 years old and you're always better off just getting a new one. So I figure I got to do this, and I can't do it sight unseen. I wasn't just going to do it online or on Amazon, because I've got to see it. I've got to know about it. I guess I'm old fashioned in that regard. So I get my mask, I get sanitizer, and I go to Micro Center. And again, this is not a paid advertisement. This is not an endorsement. And it's the Micro Center over on Elston and Logan back there. And I had shopped there in the past, and I had always had really good experiences there with knowledgeable people and solid customer service and price matching and all that stuff. So, and I don't know what to expect. First of all, it was jammed. And I asked why, and they said people are working from home. People are now realizing how old and bad their computers are and what they need for their Zoom meetings and what they need to be productive from home. And people are gaming more, but it's just, there's been a rush there. They said they've had nonstop activity of people, same thing, people overworking their devices or needing to upgrade their devices and transitioning into the device being absolutely indispensable. So as I walk in, there is a young man in a mask with gloves in the antechamber, in the alcove in between the sliding doors. And he says, welcome to Micro Center. He says, have a good day. Just want to make sure that you're wearing a mask. I said, okay, great. Glad you're doing that. Then after you go through the second set of doors, there is a woman in full PPE, face shield and gown and gloves, with a container of industrial hand sanitizer. And she says, may I sanitize your hands? And I sanitized my hands. She had a box of masks there, of surgical masks, in case I didn't have mine. And she had small, medium, and large latex gloves. And said, you know, take these gloves if you'd like. And wow, this is... Then they also had the... First of all, it was one out, one in, as far as how many people could be in the store. And there's tape all over the floor of where you're supposed to walk, and don't go down this. This is a one-way aisle, and this is a one-way aisle, and there can only be X number of people in this particular area at a given time. And I was able to have a short conversation with a salesperson who was wearing a mask and gloves, and I picked out what I wanted, and he said, okay. And he said, I have to go to a computer. I'm going to punch some things in, and it's going to be waiting for you at the front. And then it was a touchless transaction at the end. And before I walk out, another man comes up to me and he introduces himself and he says, my name is Ahmed. I am the general manager of the store. And I wanted to personally thank you for coming here today and thank you for our business and to let you know that if there's any issue with your equipment for anything you purchased today, to contact me directly. And my information is available on the website. And it was just the entire process was so well choreographed and so thoughtful that I'm hopeful that other businesses are actually doing business in the same way that Micro Center in Chicago is doing business. I don't know how many there are. I don't know if they're publicly owned or privately owned. I don't know who owns them. I don't know anything about it. But I just did want to say nice job, because it really was an example of a conscientious business doing right by their customers. And that is the Midday Midway. We do it most days right around 10:40. And coming up next, we're going to check back in with what's going on in baseball. Some confusing things are happening right here with what owners are saying is going on and then what players are saying is going on. We're going to sort it all out with national MLB writer Evan Drellich of The Athletic. He is going to join us next. I'm Dan Bernstein, 9 a.m. to noon, live and local on The Score.
start every morning with Mully and Haw from your smart speaker at home.
We've got our friend Ron is on the south side. How you holding up, buddy?
I'm hanging in there, guys. Listen to you all every day, and that's it. You know, waiting for baseball.
Mully and Haw, Chicago's number one sports morning show. Mornings 5 to 9 on Sports Radio 670 The Score, a radio.com sports station.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.